From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a special hour, musicians and their muses. Violinist Regina Carter plays homage to the unmistakable voice of Ella Fitzgerald.
Whenever I would put Ella Fitzgerald's albums on, it would just make me feel very warm and loved inside. I realized what a gift, a phenomenal voice she had.
Also today, Luciana Souza on writing music for the poetry of Leonard Cohen.
I just literally fall in love with his poetry and then am possessed and have to set it to music.
And how David Bowie's death changed jazz musician Donny McCaslin.
He was just an exceptional person and artist, and making Black Star and working with him was a profound experience for me and the band. So I wanted to just pay tribute to him.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is a special holiday edition of Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell.
Lazy John, tell me where you've been.
As British novelist E.M. Forster famously wrote, "Only connect, live in fragments no longer." That could be the spirit of the holidays for most of us, connecting and reconnecting with neighbors, friends, and family to stop living in fragments. So in that spirit, we've put together some of our favorite conversations about a special kind of connection. Musicians talking about the muses who inspired them to new creativity. We'll start with banjoist composer and producer Jamie Stone. Here's his song Lazy John, which is based on a traditional ballad from Kentucky composed by folklorist and song collector Alan Lomax.
Lazy John, tell me what you mean. I got a dozen girls in love with me, want you to be 13.
Lomax devoted his life to the preservation of folk music. He spent decades traveling the United States and Europe and made thousands of field recordings of early folk music, like early blues from the Deep South or spirituals of the Georgia Sea Islands. And Lomax's efforts had a huge impact on music. Without him, we might not have had Muddy Waters, Lead Belly, or Woody Guthrie. So in 2015, banjoist Jamie Stone celebrated Lomax's 100th birthday with new recordings of songs from Lomax's vast archive, which he released on an album called Jamie Stone's Lomax Project. Stone spoke with WBUR's Anthony Brooks about the project.
His importance is not to be underestimated. You know, and part of what inspired me was realizing that so much traditional music that I love, both American roots music and traditions from all over the world, have been collected and preserved by his work in the field for over 60 years. So this was an amazing project to undertake because it's so vast.
It is vast. I want to ask you about the vastness of that because Lomax compiled a huge catalog of recorded music, something like 17,000 tracks. How did you pick the 19 songs for this CD?
For me, it was really songs that just woke up my ear in some way, things that were unusual. It was obvious when there were standouts. And different people in the group also gravitated towards different things. So I loved a lot of the more world music elements. But one of our lead singers, Margaret Glaspie from New York, she is a songwriter and an amazing lyricist. And so for her, it was always the lyrics that really grabbed her.
Well, let's listen to one of the tracks. It's perhaps one of the best known songs on this CD, Shenandoah, which I've got to say you just do beautifully here. Let's just listen to a little bit of this. Jamie, I'd love it if you could tell me a little bit about Shenandoah, why you selected this for the album, and how it came to sound like this.
Well, this song has been with me for a long time. It's one I've always loved. I first heard it or thought of it as a lullaby, and originally it came from French-Canadian voyageurs. It's a state song, it's been in films, and it's just one of these songs that seems to be everywhere. And the story of a Missouri River tradesman who falls in love with the daughter of an Indian chief who he courts for 7 years. And there's this beautiful longing.
Lomax's original field recording didn't even include your instrument, didn't include a banjo. So these songs aren't just covers. You really developed many of these musical elements from scratch, didn't you?
Yeah, a lot of the songs that we wound up choosing were originally either just a cappella singing or with spare instrumentation. That gave us a nice blank slate.
Mm. A lot of Lomax's recordings are very traditional. You play the banjo, which some might consider a more traditional instrument, but a lot of your work has been more contemporary and international. So I'm wondering if, you know, working with Lomax's recordings and this collection, this archive of material, if it felt like a kind of homecoming for you in a way.
It really did, because I fell in love with traditional music when I took up the banjo, although I've always had my ear to the ground and been interested in musical traditions from around the world. And there are echoes and resonances of all of the European-American and African-American influence here in American roots music that I was very much aware of and wanted to explore. But it also allowed me to dig into a more traditional sound. It felt like Alan Lomax has already done the great work of preserving this, and these recordings are beautiful as they are, and yet I also wanted to bring a contemporary touch to the whole thing.
Well, let's listen to another song from Jamie Stone's Lomax project. This is Before This Time, Another Year. Some lonesome graveyard, oh Lordy, how long before I go? How long? Well, I'd like to know. How many more days till I'm wrapped in the clay? I love that sound. So that's Tim O'Brien singing there, and I understand that he wrote some of the lyrics for this song, some of his own lyrics. Tell me about that.
He did. We took this song, Before This Time Another Year, from the repertoire of Bessie Jones, who was the leader of the Georgia Sea Island Singers, and she's an extraordinary musician who is steeped in the ring shouts and work songs of the Sea Island tradition. Tim had just turned 60 about a week before we recorded it, and he called me up the morning of the session and said, what do you think of this? And he puts the phone down and just starts playing and singing a bunch of new verses where he talks about 60 rings on his tree of life.
I count 60 rings on my tree of life. I take comfort and joy with all this trouble and strife.
And what you hear on the record is actually, you know, the first time we'd all really heard those lyrics and sang together. So there's a real tangible chemistry happening.
Bula is a man, never say his prayers. Don't wash his foot, never walk for days.
Well, I want to talk about another song on the album, very different from what we've heard so far. It's called Bury Bula for Me. Let's listen.
Bula don't work, no pay for a cent. Couldn't rent a place, he can't pay no rent. Bonds run, bury Bula for me.
That's the voice of Drew Gonsalves, who has a band called Cobo Town. We've been dear friends for a long time, and he turned me on to Lomax's Trinidadian recordings. This is a song about a corrupt police officer, and every verse tells further sordid details of what a despicable person he was.
He went with a cent, he whooping a rent, well, I never see a dog ratting on a cent. Bonds run, bury Bula for me.
All those calypso songs are so infectious, you just want to dance to them, although they were like the newspapers of the day. And topical songs were a big part of the calypso tradition.
They do want to make you move, though. It's hard to listen to that and not want to move.
Mm-hmm.
Bonds run,
I know that you visited the archive of folk culture at the Library of Congress and listened to Lomax's field recordings in a quiet room, and here's what you wrote about that. You wrote, "You hear life teeming in the background, a dog barking, someone in the kitchen, kids out back, roosters in the yard. You hear the repartee of breathing, the pauses." Now, the CD that you've produced is a studio recording, but did you try to work some of that authenticity into the recordings?
Authenticity is such a tricky subject when we're talking about folk traditions, because even in the so-called backwaters that Alan was out recording in, you know, there was the music of Tin Pan Alley. This is certainly a studio recording. I wanted the music and the instruments to be as sonorous as possible. We didn't particularly try and make it sound like a field recording. The only thing that might have come close were the several pieces that are just a cappella or singing and hand clapping or body percussion. And those we just did crowded, literally eight of us crowded around a stereo pair. And those, you can really feel the breathing of the group, and there's a kind of congregational feeling.
Oh, yes, my Lord, I know the road.
Yes, Lord, I know the road.
Oh, yes, my Lord, I know the road.
Yes, Lord, I know the road.
Young sheep don't know.
Jamie, I just want to talk about one more song that has sort of that spontaneous group quality that you were sort of alluding to a moment ago. It's called "I Want to Hear Somebody Pray." Let's listen.
I want to hear somebody pray. I want to hear somebody pray. Down in the valley over yonder, I want to hear somebody pray.
This song comes from a woman named Edith Hector on the island of Carriacou in the Caribbean, where he visited in 1962. Mm. And again, it was just singing and clapping, but there were qualities of West African music that I heard in this very simple call and response song.
I want to hear somebody pray. Oh, I want to hear somebody pray.
Well, it's just a wonderful sound. Jamie, this project took years to complete. What? Why? Why did it take so long? What were you doing in all those years while you put this project together?
The idea of the project is based on what I call a collaboratory. Mm-hmm. And so we did a series of residencies where all these different musicians got together in different configurations and constellations. And we would turn each other on to these different field recordings, sift through the many hundreds of possibilities, and then we would often finish with some teaching and then performances. And so we did 2 years of that before recording, and so there was already a vast repertoire to choose from. And so it was a real labor of love. I actually feel like I fell down a well in the best of ways, and really still feel like I've only scratched the surface.
Down in the valley over yonder, I want to hear somebody play.
That's banjoist, composer, and producer Jamie Stone speaking with WBUR's Anthony Brooks. His album, Jamie Stone's Lomax Project, came out in 2015 and was based on the field recordings of folk music collector Alan Lomax. Stay with us. Coming up, musician Regina Carter pays tribute to Ella Fitzgerald's voice with her violin. I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is Radio Boston. Thank you. Welcome back to a special holiday edition of Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell. All this hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite conversations with musicians talking about the people who inspired them. We just heard from the banjo player Jamie Stone and his album that celebrated the centennial of folklorist and song collector Alan Lomax. Regina Carter, a jazz violinist and MacArthur genius, did something similar to mark the 100th birthday of one of her favorites, Ella Fitzgerald.
How can I be free when I still remember how you could thrill me with a sigh?
Just last like year, Carter put a new spin on some of Fitzgerald's classics, like I'll Never Be Free, with her album, Ella, Accentuate the Positive. It's a unique way to celebrate her, as the album has no words. Carter's violin instead pays tribute to Fitzgerald's unmistakable voice. Carter spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last year.
First of all, I wanted to pay homage to her, and it's a nod to Ella, so I can't, no one can be Ella. Yeah. It's just to, so taking these tunes, first of all, is to respect the lyrics mm-hmm. and respect the melody and to play that, and to know, not to box myself in stylistically, because that's not what she did.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something different with the arrangements, and I grew up in Detroit. I'm a Motown baby. I love, you know, Motown, R&B, soul. So with this record, I wanted to treat the arrangements like they were 50s, 60s R&B, uh-huh. soul, with a soul vibe, like a Mavis Staples or Otis Redding. And it's just some great material. I didn't choose, all the tunes on the record are not necessarily very famous tunes yeah. that she recorded. There are a few on there that people will recognize. But I figured so many people would do Ella tribute records because this will be her 100th mm-hmm. birthday coming up. I wanted to showcase some of the tunes that were lesser known, her yeah. B-side her B-side tunes, if you will.
Well, so let's hear a little bit more of what you've done on the album. Again, the album's called Ella, Accentuate the Positive. And here in a moment, we're going to hear your version of Crying in the Chapel. But first, let's hear the original by Ella Fitzgerald.
You saw me crying in the chapel. The tears I shed were tears of joy. I know the meaning of contentment now. I am happy with the Lord.
And here is Regina Carter's version. I hear what you mean about putting that 50s or 60s twist on it mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, this arrangement was written by a great young bassist, Ben Williams. And it was just exciting to hear all of the different approaches that the different arrangers took on these tunes. And it makes it fresh for us, the player as well, to do something different with it and keep it exciting. Yeah. But Ella, because she experimented with so many different styles, I wanted to keep with that
right.
as well on this record.
Right. So for people who don't know you, or they don't know you enough, and your career, remind us. You said you had grown up in Detroit,
yes.
and you first started learning violin in the classic way. When you were young, you didn't just dive into jazz violin. But how'd you make that turn?
Well, I was a Suzuki baby. I started when I was 4 years old in Detroit, and it's a method where you learn to play by ear, and then you learn to read later. So I think that was very helpful because I could hear things and repeat them. And when I was in high school, my dearest friend, who's a great jazz vocalist, Carla Cook, brought me records of three jazz violinists, Stephan Grappelli, Jean-Luc Ponty, and Noel Pointer. I had no idea that you could do this with the violin. I was so excited. And so I took these records home and I started learning the tunes and learning their solos and improvising. And this opened my world up. There was a freedom to the music and I just really fell in love with this and decided this is what I wanted to do as my career.
Yeah. Well, you attended New England Conservatory for a couple of years,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But they didn't have a jazz course there at that time.
They did, actually.
Oh, they did?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. And I auditioned for both departments and got in both, but I was with the classical department for the first year, and then I switched to the jazz department. And then after my second year, I felt like I needed a campus. So I transferred to Oakland University back in Rochester, Michigan, and then I studied with the likes of trumpeter Marcus Belgrave, organist Lyman Woodard, and so many of the – Detroit had a thriving jazz scene, so I'd studied with a lot of the musicians there.
Mm-hmm. So take us back to the current album, Ella Accentuate the Positive. You talked about it at the beginning a little bit, but what's your personal relationship with Ella Fitzgerald's music like?
I grew up in my household, we listened to all kinds of music. And sometimes, you know, I just run across records maybe in the closet or something. And I remember specifically Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald. And whenever I would put Ella Fitzgerald's albums on, it would just make me feel very warm and loved inside. As I matured, I realized what a gift, a phenomenal voice she had. And there was just something, I always listened to Ella. She was always in my playlist. And a couple of records, I've recorded tunes in the past of tunes that she's done. And with her birthday coming up, I thought this would be the perfect time just to do a whole record dedicated to her, a nod to her. And it was just like it's just so much material to choose from. And this is exciting for me. And just her whole, all the reading and research I've done about Ella, she always seemed like a very positive person. Mm-hmm. I remember a quote, which I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember, but it's where there is love, I don't think you can go wrong. You know, just, and I think being a positive person, being honest, and doing something in love, we can all live by that.
Hear, hear. Well, let's hear a little bit more. Again, the new album from Regina Carter is called Ella Accentuate the Positive, but I want to play, first of all, one of Ella Fitzgerald's originals, and then we'll hear your version of it. This is one of my favorites. Imagine my frustration.
Sat down by the wall, invited to
I mean, it just gets better and better. My crew in there in the control room is like, you got to talk again. We're running out of time. We can listen to the whole song, though. Okay.
It's such a great
it's such
tune.
Such a great song. Man. Well, let's hear Regina Carter's version of this. How much fun is that?
I love that tune. It's such a grooving tune. Imagine my frustration at no invitation to dance.
The Wallflower Ella Fitzgerald. I mean,
I don't
come
think
on.
So.
No, Ella Fitzgerald played that with Duke Ellington
yes.
at the piano, right?
Yes, yes. Ella at Duke's place. Yes.
Okay. So tell me again. I guess it's the same question I asked a little earlier, but walk me through the process a little bit when you take such a well-known song like this and you're crafting a new arrangement for you and for the violin specifically.
Well, Well, just because I like a tune doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for me or on my instrument. So I take the tune and I take it to the band and we try playing it. And I always record and listen back to see if it works or not. And sometimes it does and I'm happy, but sometimes it just doesn't work and I don't know why. It just doesn't, maybe doesn't lay right on the instrument, or maybe it's the way I'm approaching the tune. But once I find the tunes that I feel work on the violin and I can really express myself with the tune, then we start playing around with it and come up with an arrangement. And even, you know, we go in the studio, record the tunes, and then when we go on the road and start playing them, those arrangements grow and change into something else, which is beautiful. It's like cooking. You put in the spices, and how it tastes on Monday is going to taste even better on Wednesday.
Yeah. I'm going to guess that, okay, so I'm going to guess that Ella Fitzgerald herself would have adored these arrangements.
I would hope so.
I'm just going to put it out there.
I would hope so. I respected the music. I respect the melody. And I think from what I've read of her, I think she would have been open to that.
That's jazz violinist and MacArthur fellow Regina Carter speaking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last year. Carter will never know how her idol felt about her musical interpretations. But one musician we spoke with did get input from her muse.
I built my house beside the wood so I could hear you singing. And it was sweet and it was good and love was all beginning. Fare thee well, my...
That's Grammy Award-winning musician Luciana Souza's Night Song. And she took the lyrics verbatim from the poem and song Nightingale by the late musician and writer Leonard Cohen. Souza had known Cohen personally, and when she asked him if she could set his words to music, he said no. So she had to ask him again and again until finally he agreed. Souza went on to turn several of Cohen's poems into songs, including four on her 2018 album, The Book of Longing.
Fare thee well, my nightingale, I live but to be near you. Though you are singing somewhere still, I can no longer hear you.
As you can hear, the songs are reflective, evocative, and the compositions are minimal. Cohen's words and what's behind them take center stage. Luciana Souza spoke with WBUR's Callum Borchers when she was in Boston last month, and he asked her just what it was that drew her to Leonard Cohen.
Well, what doesn't, really? That specific book, the poem, the book that contains that poem is called The Book of Longing, which is also the name of my record. But it's a book that was given to me by my husband in 2006, the year I moved to Los Angeles to marry him. And the book came out and he gave it to me, and he was friends with Leonard for many, many years. He gave it to me and he said, I think you would like this. And it became my companion as I transitioned from living in New York to living in Los Angeles. And this poem is crack in the middle of the book. And Leonard's poetry is just very direct, refined and poetic, I guess. But also it speaks like language to me. It doesn't seem like something I have to go study or learn other vocabulary or language or get too concerned about. As a Brazilian who's always translating into English, it just jumps off the page. And it's very musical because he writes usually in rhyme and with great meter and, you know, he just knows what he's doing so well that it becomes quite musical, and I just literally fall in love with his poetry and then am possessed and have to set it to music.
And you have a long love affair with poetry, right? Your mother was a poet,
exactly.
I understand. But I've heard you say that this particular recording is your most important in terms of your relationship with poetry. Why is that?
Well, I think because I've arrived at a certain age. I'm now 52, and this record I've written the last 3 years as I turn 50. And it's not the number, really, Callum, but it's really the compiled decades, you know, and my ability to get to my truth as I'm writing a song. I think in the beginning, my music was much more complex, and I needed complexity, I guess, to get to some place. But now I just want to distill everything to the most basic thing. So I'm writing really quite simple music, very triadic, almost hymn-like. You know, like if you sit at the piano, you'd play literally three notes and you would have a chord, like a triad, as opposed to writing really complex jazz pieces in odd meters. And, you know, the poetry is simple, the melodies are simple, And it's really to allow the words to be heard and the story to be told.
So your last album was called Speaking in Tongues, right? And
yes.
It was heavy on scat.
Yes.
And I'm curious whether a project like that, in which you strip out the words for the most part, gives you a more of an appreciation for words when you reintroduce them into your new album.
Indeed. And I think I missed, I mean, I never really left words, but yeah, when you spend a lot of time scatting and doing wordless music, I crave words and I need them. So I never leave them, but I guess this record is really me coming back full on to words.
Is it daunting to adapt these poems? I mean, we're talking about some of the works
it's
by people.
It's intimidating. It's quite intimidating. I mean, you can imagine, I'm Brazilian coming into this language and these master, you know, literary people. But again, I've done it enough. And right now I really don't feel like apologizing or, you know, making excuses for anything. I just want to do it. And I'm given permission by the estates. But what's intimidating about it is that the poetry doesn't need me. It's a finished product. It's a finished masterpiece. So I really need to bring something to it. And that's what I try to do, and hopefully successfully on this record.
And you do have some original compositions on the Book of Longing.
I do, which is even more daunting.
I
mean, to include myself.
Starting from scratch.
Exactly.
And in fact, the album begins with one of your own songs, right? It's called These Things. Let's listen to a little bit of that one.
Thank you. These are the days of long, long nights. These are the tables we set out to feed. These are the flags we wave. These are the flags we wave. These are the roads less traveled.
And so when you think about an album as sort of a full work, is it difficult to sort of pair your own original works with these existing, as you said, masterpieces by beloved poets?
It is, but you know, I'm lucky that I'm married to a phenomenal producer, musician. His name is Larry Klein, and he has such great experience programming a record. But he said, it's okay to start with your piece. It's okay. You're not, you know, it's not going to feel wrong. This is the piece that needs to open the record. And once I heard his sequence, I really agreed with it. And that's why collaborating is so good, especially with people that really know what they're doing.
So you've brought a keyboard for us. You're
yes.
ready to play, I understand.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you'll play for us the final song from the Book of Longing. It's called Remember. The lyrics are adapted from a 19th century sonnet by Christina Rossetti. Could you tell us a little bit about Remember first and then play a little bit for us?
Remember was the last poem that I set to music for this recording. And I wanted something final for the record. And I wanted something that would feel... In Brazilian language, we have a word called saudade, which is specific to Portuguese. But it translates into melancholy or a feeling of longing. And I wanted a final song, but that wouldn't be final in terms of, okay, this is it and strong, but something quiet that could leave you kind of thinking. And it's final, but it's also hopeful, and it continues, it unfolds. So it's a very simple melody, and it's a poem about not grieving about something you lose or someone who leaves. So if you can stand that, if you can stand losing someone or leaving someone or leaving something and missing them, but not necessarily hurting, just longing for them.
What a great introduction. Would you play some for us?
Of course. Remember me when I am gone away, gone far away into the silent land. You tell me of a
Yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterwards remember, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption that once I had, better by far you should forget and smile, than that you should remember and be sad, be sad, be sad.
That's Luciana Souza performing Remember from her new album, The Book of Longing. Luciana, I've seen you say elsewhere that performing music like this to poetry, writing poetry, setting poetry to music is almost an act of resistance. What are you resisting? What do you mean by that?
Well, the world is loud and busy, and people are in a hurry and not absorbing things, not thinking about language, not thinking about how they speak, how they behave. I mean, that it feels like this to me. I'm raising a 10-year-old, and I'm constantly saying, let's slow down, let's take a breath, let's stop and see what we're doing, let's observe our thoughts, let's observe our actions, and then proceed. So the fact that you would sit down and read poetry seems to me like an act of resistance at a time when everybody's just reading the news feed and, you know, and scrolling through things and speeding through things. The fact that you would let a thought go inside, reverberate within your existence and your ideas and your thoughts at that moment, and then go on with your life, seems like something different. And in that way, allowing you to go inside and see where you are and who you are in the world. It seems to me, it feels personal to me, that it personally to me that it's an act of resistance, at least on my part.
You're sort of resisting the tension of everyday life.
Yeah, and also paying attention. I think that's what poetry forces you to do, to concentrate, and it demands of you that you are present for it.
That's Luciana Souza speaking with WBUR's Callum Borchers last month about her album, The Book of Longing.
I've worked at my work, I've slept at my sleep.
Coming up, how working with his hero, David Bowie, transformed Donny McCaslin's music. I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is Radio Boston.
Leave what is full need in the spirit.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell. All this hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews with musicians about people who inspired them. For Berklee Music alum Donny McCaslin, that was David Bowie.
Poor soul, spit upon that poor soul.
The Donny McCaslin Group were the featured band on David Bowie's final album, Black Star, and collaborating with Bowie, a once-in-a-generation rock star, had a profound impact on McCaslin. And that inspiration took a different turn after Bowie's death in 2016, with McCaslin's album Beyond Now. The album is an homage to David Bowie and features covers of two Bowie songs. One is A Small Plot of Land, which we're listening to now, and the other is called Warsawa. McCaslin spoke with WBUR's Deborah Becker back in 2016 about Bowie's music and the man himself.
So much emotion, which I have to wonder whether and how much a sense of mourning played into your selection of the songs because of what had happened to David Bowie.
Yes, yeah, it's you know tough for me to talk about, but especially
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Especially Warsawa, because we were about to play a week-long engagement at the Village Vanguard in January. I think this was the third week of January. And, you know, everything had just happened, and it was such a difficult time emotionally. And we were talking about wanting to pay tribute to David, what was the best way to do it, what would feel appropriate. And Jason Lindner, our keyboard player, suggested Warsawa, and we played it at the sound check, and then we ended up playing it every set of the week, every set of that week, and it just felt like it felt emotionally cathartic to have that song to funnel all these feelings through. Mm. So that was the beginning, and that was the one they said, well, you know, would love to record this, record our version of it. And then the overall thing with the record, even as I started writing the music in the summer, a lot of the music from Black Star and David's music was kind of running in my mind. And he was just an exceptional person and artist. And making Black Star and working with him was a profound experience for me and the band. So I wanted to just pay tribute to him.
Right. How did you meet David Bowie?
Well, it was through Maria Schneider, mm-hmm. who I've played with for many years, and she was collaborating with David on a song called Sue, on a version of that with her big band, which I'm a part of. And when she was meeting with him, she suggested to him that he do something with me. And she played him a record of mine called Casting for Gravity, and that's sort of what started it, evidently. I think she suggested it again, and then she brought David down to hear us play at the 55 Bar, this little club in New York City. And it was about a week after that where I met him for the first time at the first rehearsal for Sue. We started talking, and he asked me for my email address, which seems funny to us, you know. But it was, you know.
Were you shocked?
I mean, I had an inkling because Maria had been telling me about their conversation. So I had an inkling that he was, that something might happen. But still, it seemed surreal to be meeting him and everything. But he was so wonderful and so present when we were together. And, you know, even though he was this icon and major star, you know, you just felt really at ease with him. Just a wonderful person.
Well, I want to make sure we get a little bit of music in. Let's play a little bit of the saxophone from David Bowie's Black Star. Let's listen. Very nice. Very nice. Donnie McCaslin, tell us about that collaboration process and how the saxophone solo. What were you thinking when this was happening?
Well, I think I was really trying to immerse myself in his music. And he had sent me demos before the Black Star sessions. And I just felt like I didn't really know what to expect in the studio. I worked with him on Maria's song, but Maria was conducting that session. It was with her big band. It was what I was used to. So I didn't know sort of how things would go. So I just tried to really know every song as deeply as I could, and then was trying to play from that place of knowing the song and trying to serve the music, I guess you would say. He was very passionate, and he sang with a lot of conviction. And I know that emotion was inspiring me to play. And that's, I think, kind of one of the things that I go to as a musician is going for emotional expression. And so I felt, you know, in my group, a lot of what we do as improvisers is feed ideas off each other, and there's a lot of conversational stuff happening. And he stepped right into that. And we were doing it now within the framework of his songs, but he really participated in that. As we were throwing ideas to each other, he was also, you know, pushing us and stuff. So it was really fun. Mm. You know, it was really, really inspiring. So I guess I remember when we played that, I think that was the first take of that song, and I was just kind of thinking about the song. And not trying to come in with an agenda of like, well, I've practiced this and I can do this on the saxophone and I can play this. I tried to let go of all of that and just be in the moment, the way that I saw him being in the moment as an artist. Mm. And I just wanted to just play the music that was presented to me.
Was it difficult at all when you were working with him to sort of try to maintain your own voice? You know what I mean? Well, uh-huh. He could be easily overshadowed by a David Bowie, and it sounds like he didn't want that to happen, but how do you sort of make sure it doesn't?
Right? Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing was it was my band, and we have so much history together going into that helped. It wasn't like I was just a hired gun coming in to play a couple solos. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this group, and we know each other, we played, we traveled together, so we have our language already coming into that, and I think that really helped. And then also David was really, couldn't have been more open to any suggestion I might have or anything I wanted to try. He set the environment at the very beginning of like, let's just go for this, let's see what happens. I don't, you know, let's not worry about what, you know, style of music this is. Let's have a good time and let's do this.
How do you think all of that's affected this new album?
The relationships deepened in my band because of Black Star, just musically and because of everything that happened. So I think that's one thing that has really affected the new record, is just this deeper sense of connection within the band, deeper sense of interplay. I think because of everything that happened, this record, there's a sense of emotional catharsis about it when we were making it, and I wanted it to reflect the feelings of everything that had happened. So and I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that.
I want to listen to a little bit more of Black Star. This is the track Lazarus, and I think it's a good example of some jazz influence here. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
This way.
That's the song Lazarus from David Bowie's final album, Black Star, featuring the Donny McCaslin Group. Donny McCaslin, when you hear these songs now, when you hear this album, do you have a greater appreciation? What does it feel like now that it's all together?
I feel like it was a really special experience that'll stay with me for the rest of my life. And hearing the record is I'm really proud of the way it sounds. I'm proud to be a part of it, and I marvel at his vision for putting these songs together, the way he wrote these songs. I'm grateful to him for entrusting us, you know, with being a part of it. It was just tremendous. I mean, I don't listen to the album a lot because of all the feelings involved, but when I do, I really enjoy it, and I think he sounds so great on it, and the lyrics are so profound.
Look up here, I'm in heaven.
That's saxophonist Donny McCaslin of the Donny McCaslin Group speaking with WBUR's Deborah Becker about his 2016 album Beyond Now, which was dedicated to David Bowie. Bowie passed away in 2016, and just this fall, McCaslin released his latest album, Blow. It's experimental, bold, soulful, a new direction for McCaslin. Perhaps even a more fitting homage to his hero, David Bowie. rock and roll's greatest shapeshifter. To bring it back to where we began, I want to end with a reflection from British novelist E.M. Forster.
If I have had any influence, I should be very glad that it had induced people to enjoy this wonderful world into which we're born, and of course to help others to enjoy it too.
That one's for our executive producer, Hitesh Hati. And that's our show for today. Our show is produced by the wonderful Jamie Bologna, Chris Sidderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our fabulous technical director, and I'm Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Happy holidays, everybody.